From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. A former Obama speechwriter turned comedy producer weighs in on Sacha Baron Cohen's latest provocation. Then Chef Marcus Samuelson presents a different view of our nation with his new PBS show, No Passport Required, all about the different food traditions of immigrant communities in America.
We are America because we're diverse and we learn and evolve from each other. I think food is a great way to experience that.
And the LA psych rock band Inner Wave has been together for a decade and the members are only in their early 20s. All that coming right up. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. We'll start today with a new Showtime series, Who is America? It's the latest socio-political satire from British comedian Sacha Baron Cohen. He's the guy whose HBO series Da Ali G Show introduced him and his elaborate characters to America in 2000. And since then, he's made two movies as his characters, Borat and Bruno. Even before Who is America debuted last night, former Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore was threatening to sue him over his appearance on the show. Moore wasn't in the first episode, but current and former members of Congress were, including Bernie Sanders and Trent Lott. To discuss how effective Cohen was at blending social satire with political messaging, I called up David Litt. He's a former speechwriter for President Obama, and he is now the head writer at the Washington, D.C. Bureau of the comedy site Funny or Die.
When I was at the White House and I wrote jokes for President Obama, the euphemism we often used was truth-telling. And that meant that you could use comedy to say something that ordinarily would get caught up in the back and forth of political debate. The example I use is that President Obama first talked about the conservative obsession with Vladimir Putin, not in a serious speech, but actually in a joke in 2014.
Last year, Pat Buchanan said, "Putin's headed straight for the Nobel Peace Prize." He said this. Now, I know it sounds crazy, but to be fair, they give those to just about anybody these days. So it could happen. But it's not just Pat. Rudy Giuliani said, "Putin is what you call a leader." Mike Huckabee and Sean Hannity keep talking about his bare chest, which is kind of weird.
I think this is a different form of truth-telling that Sacha Baron Cohen engaged in, where he's sort of prompting people and prodding people into revealing a truth about themselves that they would probably rather voters not know, and that a lot of traditional political reporting allows them to obscure.
So in the show, he plays four different characters. They're heavily made up, lots of facial hair and prosthetics. And two of the segments are pretty much directly political, involve politicians and lobbyists. Among the four segments, which ones do you think worked the best comedically?
Well, I think the segment that made the biggest splash on social media was the clip of the Kinderguardians program that a variety of Republican congressmen and then also conservative lobbyists proudly endorsed.
Let's play a little bit from that segment. He is playing somebody named Colonel Aaron Murad.
In America, there have been a lot of shootings in the school and in the university. What do the liberals say is the reason for this and the solution?
Well, they blame it on guns. Yeah, it's crazy because
they blame it on the guns?
Yes.
Mushuga.
Yes.
It's mushuga.
It is.
We start a program in Israel for kindergartens.
Okay.
We train them from the age 16 down to the age 3.
Yeah, well, I think it would be a good idea.
A couple of things happen here, and that is that there are a couple of politicians who totally endorse this not only fictional, but kind of dangerously and preposterous idea.
It's really what makes that segment so revealing, not to mention funny, a little darkly funny, is two things. So one is the preposterousness of the program, the idea that arming a four-year-old child might be something that anyone who's in a leadership position would endorse. But the second is it's exposing, I think, the way that a lot of our politicians have abandoned their critical thinking to interest groups. I think the truth is most of these politicians weren't really considering, is this idea a good idea or a bad idea? Rather, it was what already fits with my NRA-endorsed worldview. And the lack of independence from some of our politicians and some of our political leaders that we saw in episode one is pretty stunning.
One of the things you're also talking about is the whole idea of satire. And that concept seems kind of absurd right now. I mean, just today, Donald Trump said he was more inclined to believe Vladimir Putin than his own intelligence agencies about Russia's interference in the 2016 election. So how hard is it to be satirical right now?
It's very, very difficult to be a satirist these days. Right now, in addition to some of the other work that I do, I work for Funny or Die, the comedy website in Washington, D.C. And political comedy, there's all sorts of people who certainly deserve to be poked fun at, but things are so absurd that it's almost difficult to top what's actually going on.
So speaking of that, I want to play a recent Funny or Die skit. This is from last month, and it starts with a clip from the Fox News personality, Laura Ingraham.
More kids are being separated from their parents and temporarily housed in what are essentially summer camps.
Yes, it's finally here. The summer camp your kids have been begging you to send them to. The Laura Ingraham Detention Center Summer Camp Extravaganza. This abandoned Walmart used to roll back prices, but we rolled back the entire building so we can fit 1,500 kids inside. And now we can fit yours too.
So how would you describe how that fits into what you're trying to do at Funny or Die?
Well, I will start by saying I didn't write that specific sketch, so I can't take credit for it, although I think it's pretty funny. One of the things that I think good political comedians can do is tease out something that is strange or seems bizarre, but you can't quite put your finger on it in the moment. So, for example, that idea that these kids are basically at summer camp, it's immediately something that jumps out. But at the same time, it's also something that can easily be glossed over because she so quickly moves on to continue making the rest of her argument. So to force us to focus on that idea and to say, you know, in the sort of comedy world, that rule of if that, then what else? So what is she really saying when she's comparing separating kids from their parents to sending your kids to summer camp? And let's actually explore that, and let's actually not just move past it, but let's think about what it really indicates and what it's really saying. Comedy can focus our attention in a way that is really important, I think, during times like these.
Thank you so much. That was really interesting.
Thank you, and I really appreciate you having me back on. This was fun.
David Litt is a former Obama speechwriter. He's now at Funny or Die in D.C., and he's also the author of the book, Thanks Obama, My Hopey Changey White House Years. Coming up, a new travel series looks at the ways that immigrants have shaped American food and culture. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. And now, in these divided times, the new TV series No Passport Required is all about the unifying power of food in America. The 6-part series is produced by the website Eater for PBS and hosted by Chef Marcus Samuelson. If you don't know him from his restaurants like Red Rooster in Harlem, you may have seen him on shows like Chopped or Top Chef Masters. Each of the episodes of No Passport Required explores the influence of an immigrant community's food and culture on a different American city, from Arab Americans in Detroit to Mexican immigrants in Chicago to Vietnamese cuisine in New Orleans. It's a topic that's near and dear to Marcus Samuelson's heart. He was born in Ethiopia, raised in Sweden, and now calls New York City home. When I spoke with him about No Passport Required, Samuelson explained what drew him to the show.
I just love this idea, traveling around this incredible, beautiful country and meeting some incredible people and listening to their stories. Very similar, sometimes similar to my own stories about the ambition about coming to America and through food. Have an opportunity to share your life story through food, and that's really what No Passport Required is doing. And then, you know, when PBS and Eater and my team, we started collectively to shape the show in the way that we wanted it to be. You know, which cities are we going to go to? What are the communities in those cities? Those are all great questions. So starting out with Detroit and Dearborn and the Arab American community, we wanted to pick a really iconic American town, but also with a really rich culture and history behind it. And I think with these 6 cities, we were able to do that.
In the first episode, you go to Dearborn, Michigan, and you meet with Selwyn Georges, who is an Iraqi-American photojournalist, sort of your guide. And you go into the home of a Syrian refugee family. The father, Yasser Alamad, is a chef himself. He and his wife, Saiwan, prepare a meal, a real feast for you. And here in this clip, you sit down to eat it with the whole family.
Ahmed, what is your favorite dish? What do you like to eat?
I love a lot of fettuccine.
Nice. Islam, what do you like?
Pizza.
Pizza. Your mom and dad worked all day and you said pizza.
This is really good. This is really good. I've never had it before.
It's beautiful.
They want to make the country they live in beautiful.
Yeah.
All what they hope for is the chance. They just need to be given that chance that they can kind of really show their true color and really make this country proud of giving them the chance.
I'm curious, you've been around food pretty much your whole adult life. What did an experience like this show you? How were you changed by visiting with these families and spending time with them?
It was probably the most humble experience I've had in the whole show. Yasser and his family just arrived, and they could not have been more gracious to us. The display, the amount of food that they wanted to share, and the length that went into cook it, you know, they prepared for such a long time, because they just want us to have a true experience of what Syrian food can be, and that Syria, of course, can give you great foods and not just be known for one thing. And this was a recurring theme that almost every family told us, you know, whether you were a Vietnamese American or Ethiopian American or Haitian, these are very often in our news cycle, marginalized parts of the world that has rich histories, most often much older than America itself, right? Many, many times. So these are extremely proud people. They're proud to be American, but also proud coming from their old country. And all I want to do here is just to get a chance to be able to express themselves and work and contribute.
The other thing that you're really kind of touching on is this whole idea of assimilation. What part of your culture you retain as you become quote unquote American, and what part of American culture do you absorb? Did it start to make you think about your own background as an immigrant, and what part of you is tied to the countries where you were born and grew up in, and what part of you is tied to the country where you now live?
Well, I think Yasser's kids had it right. Pizza, that made them officially Americans. But I think, yes, these are things that I struggle with constantly. How much Ethiopian am I? How much Swedish am I? I live now with my family in Harlem and I'm American. What I love about America is that I don't have to compromise on my Swedish or Ethiopian values to become a Harlemite, to become an American, to become a New Yorker. And that's something that is extremely unique and beautiful and we should celebrate, you know? We are America because we're diverse and we learn and evolve from each other. Food is a great way to experience that. This is a place where you can have fattoush one day, but you can also have pizza this next day. And this is something that I think, again and again, we can't talk enough about, especially in times like now when the immigration conversation is a very, very hot topic, and the false narrative about immigrants are not contributing and it's not working hard. Nothing could be further from the truth. Nothing.
We're talking with Chef Marcus Samuelson about his PBS series, No Passport Required. I want to ask you a question about kind of the idea of cultural appropriation through food. In your Chicago episode, you don't talk about the chef Rick Bayless, but he spent 6 years doing culinary research in Mexico before he published his cookbooks about Mexican cuisine and Open Frontera and Tablo Bompo. But what about chefs who just borrow from another country's culture and food without really understanding it? Is there a problem about appropriation in food from chefs who don't really know what it is they're doing or basically stealing another culture's cuisine?
Well, I mean, in terms of Chef Rick Bayless, that has been an amazing educator in terms of culture. And I don't, Rick has a tremendous amount of love and respect for Mexican cuisine. He goes with his team every year to study it. I've always been a huge fan of Rick. And this was also an opportunity to show another side of Chicago, you know, to highlight a chef like Diana and be there when she celebrated her first anniversary at her amazing restaurant, Mitukaya, but also show food that might not be in the restaurant scene, like Marcos and his father that have had their carnitas place in Pilsen for over 40 years. These are places that sometimes get looked over, but are definitely part of the food landscape. I think food, just like music, will always have this hot, debated conversation about, you know, who bars from who stole from who. And I think that's healthy. You know, it's good to have this conversation, because through this conversation, there's very often a deeper dive. And it's all about authorship, right?
Right.
Who has the authorship of certain food? And I think as long as we acknowledge where it came from and pay tribute to the people who really started the process, right? I think that's important. I don't think you can necessarily be a food police either. So I think it's a good heated conversation that will be constantly had online and in restaurants across this nation.
And one of the things you actually say in your Chicago episode, and I'm quoting you now, is the Mexican community in America is what made America taste great again. If you take away the Mexican-American community in this country, our food does not taste good. Every chef I know would agree with that.
Not just chefs. Any person would agree with yeah. that. I mean, how could you not? I know there's a lot of people in the government right now that goes to Mexican restaurants a lot, so I'm sure they agree with it too.
Yeah, sometimes they're heckled there, like the woman who runs Homeland Security. I'm wondering if you have thought about the idea of restaurants being a safe space, if people, when they go into a restaurant, you know, can open themselves up, as has happened recently, to people criticizing their politics and their policies.
Well, I mean, first of all, I mean, if you treat people nice in generally, you will be treated nice. You know, if you respect people and the culture, I'm sure people will have no problem serving you. And I think that, you know, specifically as a black person, America fought really, really hard to get restaurant integrated. And so we have a very important history where we came from in this. Each restaurant owner are allowed to do however they choose to do, you know. I probably would, you know, I've never thrown someone out. I would probably pull up a chair and talk a little bit more about immigration instead, you know, have some more kimchi or have some more Ethiopian dora wat. And, you know, I think food has always been the center of breaking bread and bringing people to the table. And restaurant has a very, very important role to play in that. But in generally, I think if you are peddling false narratives, people's going to be very, very upset about that. And you can't really control the outcome of that.
Let me ask you this last question. In some ways, it feels as if there's a certain aspect of this show that is a continuation of what Anthony Bourdain did with his series Parts Unknown. I know that you knew each other and you were even in the 2015 episode about Ethiopia. Obviously, you started this work while Anthony was still with us. Do you think this series is in some ways now a continuation of what he was exploring?
I mean, Anthony gave us a lot. He gave us, as chefs for our community, he gave us a lot to be inspired by. He gave the non-chef community something to connect us with and connect us to the living room, to worlds and parts where most people have never seen. So I can't thank Anthony enough for opening up this conversation. As we were doing this show, I was constantly looking and thinking about Anthony and our trip to Ethiopia and how, you know, he's an amazing listener. He was an amazing listener. You know, he came with my wife and I to our home village, and he just sat in those huts and ate the food that everybody there ate. There was just no food that he wouldn't try and no conversation he wouldn't listen to. So I learned a lot from Anthony, and I cherish everything that he gave us. And, you know, I just really hope that he would have enjoyed the show, because it's obviously he's been a huge inspiration to all of us who created this show. And the first episode we dedicate to him.
Marcus, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Marcus Samuelson is the host and executive producer of No Passport Required. It airs Tuesdays on PBS. Coming up next on The Frame, the young members of the LA band Inner Wave have a sound that's straight out of South LA. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Are you getting ready to head out on vacation? Well, fear not. You won't miss a single episode of our show if you subscribe to our podcast. So imagine yourself on a beach while you enjoy our upcoming interviews with actor David Diggs and photographer Mark Seliger. You can get The Frame from only the finest podcast providers. And now members of the Inglewood psych rock band Interwave have been jamming together since they were middle schoolers. Over the past 11 years, they've gone from playing local church gigs to sold-out shows, and just recently, they were able to quit their day jobs and hit the road on their first North American tour. The band recorded two new singles this summer following their ambitious 2017 release, Underwater Pipe Dreams. They're back out on the road now, but before leaving town, two of the group's members stopped by our studios to speak with Frame producer Jonathan Shiflett, and they began with their first days of playing music together.
I remember saying that I kind of didn't want to start a band until I was older, like 18 for some reason. And then the next day they're like, dude, we're starting a band. You play guitar, Eli plays guitar, Gene's going to learn how to play bass. And we kind of just practiced every day. And we didn't even have our first show until like eighth grade.
Was that when you guys started that Christian rock band?
Nah.
Before I joined the band. And when they were in middle school, they had like a little Christian rock band going on.
Well, you gotta add little in front of it, bro. Yeah.
Because y'all were
little. Gotta put a little.
Y'all were tiny. That. It was a tiny band. What's up? This is Chris Runners. I play keys.
My name is Pablo. I play guitar and I sing. Gene and Eli and Portillo aren't here right now. Yeah, we've been playing for 11 years together. I started playing music in church. I grew up in like a Christian evangelical church. It was all in Spanish. So the kind of music there was, it would start with like more like worship contemporary stuff. And then at some point it would just switch into like polka music almost. It's like, mm-da, 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 mm-da. But yeah, it was fun. I feel like it developed my ear. But I think the name Interwave kind of just came about because I had a whole like list of like 200 band names on my phone. And I would just ask all my friends like,
which one's the coolest? Because
I don't know.
Any bad ones you remember? Like really bad ones?
I think one of the names was Battery Bath. And that was actually the second best one. So
really?
If like a few more people would have chose that one.
Been Battery Bats?
Yeah, you'd be interviewing Battery Bats right now. The genre? Mm. Damn, I don't know. Clowncore?
Clowncore, yeah.
I've always had a hard time describing. To me, it falls under the umbrella of like alternative indie, but that's such
so broad.
Not because it's so crazy.
We're different.
Different,
yo. We're
it's
so
just
different.
Like you can't even put that into words, you know? That's At least for me, when I was younger, I remember being in middle school and thinking like, I'm never gonna make it because the only people that make music like this that make it are like white. Like yeah. People are just gonna be
especially
like,
why
aren't you
genre?
Singing in Spanish?
Yeah.
No, because I remember even going to shows when we were younger and like playing these shows and sometimes people would be like, oh, where you guys from? And I'd be like, Inglewood. And they're like, really? Oh, I thought you guys were like a Boyle Heights band. It's like, oh, that's a little
kind of messed up.
Makes sense. We really try to make a point to like write as much of the stuff together as we could.
Just because everyone in the band has so many different influences, and I feel like it comes out in all the different songs. I think sometimes we'll just start jamming, and then someone will be like, yo, this kind of sounds good. Let me get the voice memo on my phone and like throw it in the middle of the room real quick, and then they hop on, and then we'll just like go from there.
This Buffalo version 14. It's another song from the album. I don't know if I should.
We'll jam for 15 minutes and there's like a 1 minute part that we're like, yo, we gotta work on that and make that into a whole song. Pablo is definitely like the main producer filter for the whole band.
Why mix the stuff and record it? So, and then I end up kind of just playing it for the guys, just sort of teaching each part like one by one.
I really think the LA scene is picking up right now. I think it's mostly because a lot of bands are really trying to help each other and like push each other's music, and I feel like there's genuine friendships between a lot of musicians, and like they just like each other's music and we all want to see each other succeed.
It's a lot of DIY spots. I think for us that was a big thing. We started playing in like warehouses in Gardena, this place called The Colony. Shout out to The Colony. So that kind of thing is a big help. And sometimes going to venues when you're not a bigger act can be a real pain, because it's like, yeah, dude, you want to play? Yeah, like,
come bring
pay up.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not healthy for like cultivating art.
We've been like completely independent for a long time. Like, I think until maybe February this year, we didn't have like a manager or any like PR people or none of that. It was just like us doing everything. And it was just recently where I quit my day job. This tour is really special because it's been like an extended field trip. It's like you hop on the bus. It was funny, like right before we left for tour, we're all at Pablo's house and we're like sitting cross-legged on the floor, and our managers are up there like telling us like, hey guys, so just make sure to be safe. And it's like, I'm at a camp right now. Like, we all have our bags packed and stuff, and we're like loading in and like saying bye. And like Pablo's dad was outside waving goodbye as the van was pulling away. Just like, wow.
That is all for today. Remember to keep up with us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You will find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. We'll see you back here tomorrow.